Thank you very much, Mr. President and fellow honorary degree recipients. It's truly an honor and a great pleasure to be with all of you here this afternoon on this wonderful day, with members of the faculty and the Board of Trustees, the staff, alumni, families of all the graduates and friends who've gathered together. Deeply honored to have received this honorary degree, and I thank the university immensely. To today's graduates, may I offer my heartfelt congratulations. You deserve to be proud of your wonderful achievement that has brought you to this moment. You've come so far over these last number of years. When you first arrived on this campus, you struggled with the profound questions of human existence, nature or nurture, free will or determinism, individualism or community. Eventually, you boil those questions down to just one: Teds or Huskies. Now I know you're paying attention. Candidly, for years, I want you all to know, I have dreamed of appearing before a large audience at Gamble Pavilion. But in my dreams, I'm 6'6" and wearing short pants. With 3 seconds to go, I fire up a three-pointer and beat Duke. But oh well, at 5'9" with gray hair and a touch beyond my prime, draped in academic robes, let me just say it's still a privilege to share this day of reflection and celebration with you in this building that has been the site of so many wonderful memories for all of us. Now, I must tell you, I remember the first time that I was asked to give a commencement address. I was a young congressman from New London. I was nervous, obviously. A friend of mine, an Irish Catholic priest, shared a piece of advice that I've never forgotten when it comes to commencement addresses. In a very rich brogue, he said the following to me. "Now, Christopher," he said, "a commencement speaker is much like a guest at an Irish wake. They need you in order to have the party, but nobody expects you to say very much." So I'll try and keep that in mind this afternoon. Now, I must tell you, I've often wondered why there was a need even to have a commencement speaker, that commencement exercise. I tried to recall on the way over here what the commencement speaker at my graduation, not that many years ago, had to say. Not only can I not tell you what he or she said, I have absolutely no recollection of who it was that gave my commencement. That's how memorable these speeches can be. But being good students here, I thought I'd also do a little research and go back in time and try and discover when the first commencement address was ever given. And history tells me that the very first commencement address was given in the 12th century at the University of Bologna. And that may explain why a derivative of the word Bologna has been the single most common reaction to commencement audiences over the centuries. Now, I also tried to, also thought it might be fun to find out which was the longest commencement address ever given. At Harvard University, early part of the 19th century, the commencement address lasted 6 hours. 3 hours in Latin, 3 hours in Greek, and there was an examination at the end of it. I thought you might find it more appealing what was the shortest commencement address ever given. And I found two examples of that. One was reportedly delivered by the filmmaker Woody Allen. He was giving the commencement address at American University. He recognized the faculty, the board of trustees, the staff, the alumni, the friends, the family, and the graduates. And then he turned to the graduating class, and he said the following: "My generation has left you a perfect world. Don't go out and screw it up." And he sat down. It was the only thing he said that. My other favorite commencement address, for brevity, was given by Bob Hope, the wonderful American comedian. He was giving the commencement address at Georgetown University. He arrived at the microphone, thanked all of the faculty and the board of trustees and the other gathered dignitaries. And then he said the following to the graduating class. As you prepare to leave these hallowed halls of learning, these bastions of knowledge, these citadels of scholarship, I have just two words of advice. Don't go. And he sat down. It was the entire length of his commencement. Well, I don't intend to be anywhere near 6 hours and a little bit longer than two words, but let me just share a few thoughts with you here on this wonderful day of celebration and happiness for all of you and you and your families. In a sense, those two words that Bob Hope spoke on that commencement day, I suspect reflect how many of you feel on this afternoon in stores. There's a lot of enthusiasm, obviously, and excitement about graduating. But I suspect an awful lot of you also are having some bittersweet thoughts at this hour. And there's a certain reluctance as well as you wind up your academic careers here. You know that you have not just received a degree from this wonderful university. What you've received is an education. You've been fortunate enough to spend these past years at an outstanding college, the flagship university of this small yet remarkable corner of the world that we call our home here in Connecticut. Connecticut has historically been a place where men and women conceive of a world that can be, rather than curse the world that is. Ours is truly a state of many firsts. The first written constitution in the entire world was written in Hartford, Connecticut in 1638, the Fundamental Orders. The very first public library in America was established in New Haven in 1656. The first law school, the first trade school, the first women's school, and the first school for people with disabilities in America were all founded here in our state of Connecticut. The first automobile factory, the first computer, the first helicopter, and the first television station in the world, all brought to life here in our state. And this university has been keeping with our state's tradition of leadership. 119 years ago, this university was launched on 70 acres of land, a few wooden buildings with $5,000 of support, a faculty of three, and a student body of 12. And 63 years ago, the elected representatives in our state legislature committed $2.5 million to improve and expand the university, a sum that was then the single largest commitment of resources for any purpose in our state's history. That decision, in many ways, was a stunning act of faith in the future by the people of our state, carried out not in a moment of great abundance and prosperity such as we live in today, but during the darkest days of the worst economic crisis, the Great Depression, in the history of our country. The political leadership of that era took that courageous step because they shared a collective vision of a great public university that would prepare generations of Connecticut students for life as educated men and women. We are all the beneficiaries of that noble vision. Today, in so many respects, the words University of Connecticut are synonymous with excellence. In areas like healthcare, business, education, agriculture, the arts, literature, science, and of course athletics as well. If this university and our state that we call home are to continue to lead the nation in the 21st century, as we have in times past, then we must act as our predecessors have acted. In my view, with that same vision and with that same sense of hope. First, in my view, we must continue to support this university in its mission of excellence. Now, please understand me. I am not here to make a pitch on behalf of the Alumni Association, as important as that is. I'm here rather to ask you to explore, each and every one of you as graduates, explore ways to give back to this institution which has given so much to each and every one of you. A century and a half ago, a United States senator from New England wrote the Morrill Act. That act used the finances collected from the sale of Western lands in our country to establish the great land-grant colleges that exists throughout our nation today. MIT, Cornell, and our own University of Connecticut are legacies of that creative vision. I believe that it is time for us to enact a new moral act, a moral act for the 21st century, one that will harvest the financial abundance from the sale or lease of public airwaves to underwrite the educational demands of this new century we have just entered. But we must do more than enact new laws for these new times. I'm not a graduate of this university, although I am, as a result of your generosity today, proud to call myself an honorary Husky. Nevertheless, I feel a deep, deep sense of gratitude to this institution. UConn has done so much for our state. This university has embraced my father and my family. And I cannot begin to tell each and every one of you here today how proud my family is of the Thomas Dodd Archival and Research Center on the Storrs campus. And that's why I'm committed, during whatever time I have remaining in public life, and in whatever way I can, to build upon the reputation of this wonderful university. And I hope all of you as graduates will pledge to do the same in your time. The second brief point that I wish to make is that if our state and nation are going to continue leading in the 21st century, then we must strengthen the backbone that has made Connecticut and our country a leader in the past. We must, in my view, dramatically improve the quality of elementary and secondary education in this country. It is self-evident that our world is rapidly changing. Innovations are happening that one could scarcely imagine just a few years ago. The internet now brings the world to us on a laptop computer and in devices that we can fit in the palms of our hand. Where did the people who invented and developed these new technologies acquire their basic education? Mostly from our public schools, where 9 out of every 10 children go to school every day in America. It was in the corridors of our public schools that this remarkable period of change and progress was spawned. The great irony of this moment, which we must urgently address, is that the changes and innovations sparked in the classrooms of our public schools have in many respects been bypassed by the public schools themselves. Our communities struggle to educate students who must thrive and compete in the global economy of the 21st century under a system of education that is still rooted in the 19th century. Yet despite these shortcomings, most of our school children, thank goodness, receive a superb education. But far too many do not. Far too many children attend schools where the buildings are falling apart, the classes are too big, the computers too scarce, the discipline too lax, the promotion too easy, and dropouts and failure too acceptable. In the 19th and even the 20th centuries, we as a state and a nation could get away with an education system that allowed the children of one town or state to get the best education, while children in a neighboring town or state got something less. We cannot do that any longer. We cannot ask individual towns to foot almost the entire bill for their children's schooling, particularly our poorest communities. We can't allow the federal government, in my view, to dedicate less than 0.5% of the entire federal budget to elementary and secondary education and then pat itself on the back. In the 21st century, the national government must be a far better partner in contributing to the basic educational needs of all Americans. We can't continue on the present path, not if we want our state and nation to thrive in a global economy, and not if we believe that every child deserves a chance to obtain the best possible education. We cannot guarantee success in America, nor should we even try. But we should and can guarantee an equal opportunity to success. There are some who say that change in our elementary and secondary schools is no longer possible. They say it can't be done, that we should abandon our public schools, try something new. In my view, these naysayers don't know their history, and they don't know our state of Connecticut. As I said earlier, ours has always been a state of firsts. And so today I would ask you, the first graduating class of the 21st century, to add yet another first to the long lists of firsts for which we are known. Make Connecticut the first state in the 21st century that provides each and every child an equal opportunity to achieve a world-class public education from kindergarten to the University of Connecticut, this institution in our state, major institution. I would ask you, as graduates, to be tutors, be mentors, be coaches, teach, join the PTA, do something, anything to support our children. The third and final point that I want to share with you is to find success in your own lives as well. We can't be successful as a people if we don't consider ourselves to be successful as individuals. That said, what constitutes personal success defies easy definition. It is elusive. Yet the successful people that I have known in my life have shared several qualities in common. Let me share them with you. The Southern writer Walker Percy once wrote, and I quote him, "You can get all A's and flunk life. Success is a journey, not a destination." The diploma that you're going to receive shortly in no way makes you a success or even guarantees it in the future. It is not simply what you do, in my view, but how you do it that will determine whether or not you succeed. The honesty of your effort, the decency with which you treat others, your determination to solve problems rather than to surrender to them, and the other qualities of heart and mind that you bring to bear in your daily activities. These, in my view, are the important mileposts of life. Success is, secondly, a capacity to dream. An important but little-known American poet, Delmore Schwartz, once wrote, "In dreams begin responsibilities." Indeed, where would any of us be if we didn't dream, if we allowed ourselves to be defined by limits instead of possibilities? I've often marveled at how history's deft hand can make the dreamers of today the realists of tomorrow and expose today's realists as terribly short-sighted. Consider these statements, if you would. In 1899, the commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office said the following: "Everything that can be invented has been invented." In 1943, the president of IBM was asked about the prospects for something called the computer. He said the following: "I think there is a world market for maybe 5 computers." These statements remind us, of course, never to confuse what is with what could be. The only sure thing is uncertainty. As one of the great philosophers and baseball players of our time, Yogi Berra, once said, "It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." So I urge you, do not accept the limitations of the here and the now. I know it's trite, I know it gets said all the time, but it's important on this day, where you have fulfilled one set of dreams, to carry those dreams forward to the next chapters in your lives. A third quality of success is endurance. Someone once said that half of doing well in life is showing up, keeping appointments, honoring commitments, and answering when called. Pace yourself. Life is not a sprint, it's a marathon. You'll need a cool head and a pair of fresh legs for those inevitable moments of trial and tribulation. The legendary entertainer Sophie Tucker was once asked, "What's the secret of life?" Sophie Tucker answered, "Just keep breathing." The fourth quality of success is failure. Bob Dylan, one of the finest poets of my generation, once wrote that there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. The most successful people are not those who make the fewest mistakes. The most successful people are the ones who learn the most from the mistakes that they make. So when failure comes, and it surely will, I promise you, accept it not as a comfort, a crutch, or an excuse, but as a moment of instruction and then move on. The fifth and final characteristic of success that I want to share with you today is that in order to be fully enjoyed, success has to be shared with others. Gore Vidal, the talented and very sarcastic author, once said, "It's not enough that I succeed. Others must fail." Well, during the course of your life, you will invariably meet people who believe that they can only raise themselves up to the degree that they put others down. Resist the temptation to retaliate. Revenge can be very sweet, but let me also promise you, it leaves a very, very bitter taste after all. Encourage others. Applaud their achievements. Overlook their fumbles. And above all, particularly today, find time for your families and friends to say thank you. In the end, it is the quality of your relationships with these people, more than anything else that you'll do in your lives, that'll give you depth and meaning and a sense of purpose. In closing, I wish all of you successful journeys, full of dreams and responsibilities, endurance and very high purpose. And if all else fails, remember Sophie Tucker and just keep breathing. God bless you and thank you for listening.